Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Phil Clay. Phil is a Vietnam Marine, veteran, not of Vietnam, but of the Iraq War, and has just published a wonderful book called Redeployment, which is a series of short stories looking at the operations in Iraq from the different points of view and looking at the return of Iraq Marines and others into the culture that they found upon their return. And Phil, you've been in North Carolina to talk about your book. First, before we get going, tell us a little bit about your visit to North Carolina, and was it different from the time that you came to North Carolina to train as a Marine?
Going to Duke and meeting with scholars and students and everything. That was fantastic. Having a lot of great conversations with veterans. I was at Intrepid Life Coffee and Spirits, doing a talk with some of the vets who work there, which was really wonderful. That's certainly a little different. I was in Jacksonville. I was in Camp Lejeune. I lived in Jacksonville and Hubert while I was in the Marine Corps, which was, you know, it was nice. You're close to the beach, but
did you do your
military training? Is a little different experience.
Well, where did you do your hardcore Corps training?
I was never. I did OCS and the basic school in Quantico, but I was, you know, I was a staff officer, so I don't know how hardcore my training got. Just the sort of normal, them yelling at you and making you do a lot of physical exercise sort of thing.
But by the time you came to North Carolina to serve, you had completed whatever hardcore training for enlisted men or officers was behind you, and you forget how hard it was, maybe. I don't know.
At OCS, I spent a lot of time sweaty, and then the basic school spent a lot of time really cold.
It's interesting. There's a debate going on in North Carolina now about whether we call it Camp Lejeune, which is, we've called it for a long time, but now people want
to... Camp Lejeune.
Well, they want to Francophile it, I guess, or Jeune. You're a public relations guy. What's the right answer? What do they call it on base?
So they always called it Camp Lejeune, and then right as I was leaving the Marine Corps, they started calling it, some people started calling it Lejeune. We'll see who wins.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll watch that. They're trying to change the name.
I mean, so my name is pronounced Cly. So I have the same issue. don't blame anybody who pronounces it the way that it looks.
No, I'm sorry, I've been mispronouncing it all over. And I'm trying to promote your book. I'm promoting the wrong guy. Clay. Yeah. Is that right? Where does it come from?
Swiss German, yeah.
So, is it always spelled this way, without any umlauts or anything? I mean, is it Clay?
I think so, Clay. Yeah.
Yeah, this is great. All right, but this is not what we came to talk about. And first of all, without taking up all the time, it's a very important book for me because I've had trouble getting in the shoes of the Marines, the soldiers, and other people in service and civilians who are serving, who served in Iraq, to get the feel for the experience. And your book does, I think, the best job. Although it's fiction, it puts us in the shoes of real people, sort of like we are. You know, we can identify them. And then sees this transformative power of what this experience does. So that's my sales pitch for your book. What's your sales? What do you, you've been talking about your book now. What do you say to people to introduce them to your book?
Well, I mean, I can tell people why I wrote it, you know. I think, you know, I started the book couple months after I got back from Iraq, and the first sentence I wrote was the first sentence of the book: "We shot dogs."
Mm. This is the first line of your first of the book. It's the first line you read in the book, but it's a story, and it's the It's the title story, it's Redeployment. Yeah. Tell us about why you wrote it, and tell us about that. Yeah, this is a great story.
I'd known a couple of Marines who'd been in the Second Battle of Fallujah who had talked about the experience of seeing dogs eat corpses. One had told me about sort of shooting them to try and prevent them from doing that. I'm a dog person myself. I'm not sure why, but for some reason, that felt like a kind of entry point into thinking about this sort of strangeness of being overseas and then coming back. The kind of shift in, in worldview between being overseas and being home, right? And the strangeness and disconnect that happened. I remember, I did a 13 months in Iraq, and so when you do that length of time, you get 2 weeks of leave in between, and I flew right to New York to go home. And I remember walking down Madison Avenue, and I didn't have a hard deployment by any means, but a couple days before, I'd been, in a trauma facility where folks were coming in straight from the battlefield, and then I'm walking down Madison Avenue, and there's just zero sense of world war. And so I started writing about a Marine coming home after having had that experience, and coming home to his wife, coming home to his dog, and just what that feels like in the moment is what I was trying to figure out and trying to learn how to express. And then I started writing other stories from different perspectives. So, not just infantrymen, but there's a story from the perspective of a chaplain, from a psychological operations specialist, a mortuary affairs Marine, an artilleryman, a foreign service officer running a provincial reconstruction team trying to build up the Iraqi economy. And I wanted to, sort of imaginatively get inside these other heads and see how those experiences had shaped them, see what it was like for those folks coming home, how they tried to communicate those experiences to people who have all these sort of ideas about what war must be. And ultimately, I wanted the book to be something that readers could engage with and form their own ideas with about and kind of talk back about.
Well, I do want to talk about some of the stories, as I've indicated to you. Each one of them was powerful, a powerful look at some troubled situations of basically ordinary people. But before we do that, would you talk a little bit about how the book developed? I'm used to seeing collections of short stories, which I love short stories, but more often than not, these are sort of packaged together stories that don't necessarily have a common theme, maybe one that's imposed on them, but that they are wonderful, assorted stories from some of our fine authors. This one is different, isn't it? I mean, it's unified in the sense that it's all about people,
right,
who have found their lives changed by some sort of participation in this war.
The way that I thought of it, I thought of it very much as a cohesive work, and I wanted it to be read in order. In my mind anyway, there should be a progression. And I think that the stories are meant to talk to each other and hopefully to sort of clash. It was important to me to write narrators who, there are 12 narrators. I don't think they would all get along, right? I don't think they'd all agree with each other about what Iraq was or what it meant. And I think that's, for my mind anyway, useful, right? Because I think that sometimes, particularly, with wars, when you have readers who haven't experienced war, how do you find an entry point into that conversation, right? Because if you're a veteran, you have a certain authority to speak about war, but that's also kind of dangerous because I think people need to be challenged in order to push their ideas forward. And so I wanted to have those narrators kind of clash with each other and open a space for the reader to make kind of evaluative judgments.
Well, we're visiting, Phil, be sure that I say your name correctly. Phil, it's
Yeah.
Spelled K-L-A-Y, but it's Clyde. Like, we would say, a modeling clay with an accent. Clyde, I guess. In any event, a wonderful book, Redeployment. Phil Clay and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Phil Clay. He is the author of Redeployment. It's a book of short stories, but as we were, as he was telling us before the break, it's a woven together set of short stories that has a theme, all different individuals who participated in one way or another in the war in Iraq. Phil, as you were mentioning before the break, most I'm trying to count up, but I think most of the people who you profile were not these were not out there every day.
Combat arms.
On patrol in combat and fighting the war,
right.
But they were.
The majority of the stories are from support positions, which makes sense, right? There's a lot of support folks for any war, and I've got stories from the combat arms perspective, but I've also, it was equally fascinating and troubling and interesting to think, for me anyway, about some of the other positions that sometimes don't get talked about as much. You know, what is it like to be a mortuary affairs Marine who is preparing, collecting the remains of folks and preparing them to be sent home, right? What's it like to be a chaplain who's trying to minister to guys going through these intensely hard experiences in Marines sometimes talk about counterinsurgency as a morally bruising battlefield. I think that, getting at those other experiences, first off, it gives you a more accurate and complete picture of what war is, right? Because it's this sort of incredibly broad organization, but I think it also allows you different vantage points and allows you to talk about sort of the same issues that crop up again and again in war in different and useful ways.
It's interesting in your conversations with the veterans over in Durham, the guys who are running the Intrepid coffee shop, and we learned, I think, while they don't talk about it in any mean-spirited way, there is a feeling that that they had a different and special experience that sets them apart from those who supported them, were in supporting roles. I mean,
They just didn't like it when someone who had not been through sort of in intense combat, or somebody who wasn't, an infantryman or recon guy, sort of talked up their experience as if they had been through the sort of things that the guys like them had gone through, and that's, I think, perfectly reasonable. People tend to conflate sort of being in the military with doing one of those jobs. And yet that's a portion of the military, and they're very proud of what they've having been that, right?
Well, there is one of your stories, now I can't remember the name of it, but one of them, where your narrator takes us through the experience of sort of house to house, room by room, clearing. That's real. That's a real combat experience.
Right. Yes. Exactly.
Tell us about that story and what.
So that story is about a. It's a sergeant. It's from the perspective of a sergeant infantry guy who they're clearing a house that, they've been told, has insurgents in it, and it does, and they clear through the first floor, and there's a basement. and on the first floor, one of the guys gets shot and injured. When they go through the basement, the basement is a torture house, and there are these two Iraqis, an Iraqi army guy, an Iraqi policeman, who'd been captured, and they've been tortured, and had power drill taken through their ankles, and they've been propped up in front of a video camera, and they basically, what they realized later was that these guys had been, after being tortured, they were going to be executed on camera, and the insurgents had sort of set them up in that position and realized that they had run out of film, right? And then so they were going to get more film, and that's when this squad came through. And it's the sergeant taking his men through that experience, and then they go to, they finish that, and then they go to TQ Surgical, where the guy in their squad who was injured was taken for medical treatment to see him. And it's sort of about that squad leader trying to manage that experience for his Marines, particularly for one of his very young Marines, who has never experienced anything like that before.
It's the very roughest. You're killing, you're getting wounded, you're seeing the horror of war expressed in another way with people, neither Marines nor insurgents, but Iraqi service people being actually tortured in the most brutal way. I mean, and you can't think of war in a more horrible way, I guess, than what you tell us. But in your mind, the way you tell it right now, you're worried as much about this young Marine who's never experienced, and the sort of fatherly or big brotherly way in which his leader is watching out for him.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's an important part of the story. Is the way in which that squad leader is trying to sort of guide the Marines through the experience without kind of allowing them to dwell on it too much.
Well, in this story and the next one after Action Report, this story we've been talking about is called Fargo, and Fargo.
Frigo.
How do you say it? Fago?
Frigo.
Frigo. Frigo.
Fragmentary order.
Yeah, fragmentary, and I've messed that up. But yeah, it's you filled your story short, really a pretty short story with acronyms of the Marine Corps, knowing that most of us would not understand what they were there for. And so I asked you this question earlier when we were talking, and you didn't answer it for me. Was the intention there just to fill it up with clutter, not expecting us to go to the internet or somewhere to find out what each of these things name, but this is just sort of a starry background for the story? What was your point? I mean, why am I trying to...
There's a couple things. For that story, I mean, that narrator is probably the most kind of, how do I say this, unapologetically Marine narrator, right?
Yeah.
He's telling this story, and he's just telling it the way he'd tell it to another Marine. He's not interested in explaining the bigger picture. He's not interested in defending himself or kind of engaging in a sort of sensitive exploration of the moral issues in that story. He's aware of them, and that's what he's kind of helping his guys navigate through, but he's not going to sort of talk about this stuff in any kind of touchy-feely way, right? It's very sort of nuts and bolts, and I think that, you know, the way that somebody talks tells you a lot about them, and I wanted up front, certainly for that story, you know, this is the guy that you're getting, right?
Yeah,
you know, he's very different. You know, there's a chaplain who is later sort of, you know, kind of working his way through kind of moral issues and the way that men react to combat stress and all these sort of things. And doing the kind, and you know, that chaplain is doing the kind of.
I tell you what, Phil. Let's take a break and then talk about that story.
Sure.
I hate to leave this one without saying, other than that, you had the choice that other authors have when they're dealing with someone who talks in a dialect or in a special way of cleaning it up and destroying the mood of the person's speech, or taking it as that person would say it, and you chose to just take it as
the alienation is a little bit of the point, you know.
Yeah.
This is a very different culture, and that should be, and that's up front. And I think, and it was very important to me that the story be intelligible, even if you didn't understand every term. But it I thought it was important to have those words.
I like that. We're talking to Phil Klei about his book, Redeployment. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Phil Klei. He's the author of a new book, Redeployment. It's a series of short stories all set either in Iraq during the war or among the challenges that returning vets and others faced when they came back. Before the break, you began to tell us about your story about a chaplain and some of the challenges that he faced. It was a most interesting story. Tell us some more about it.
So the chaplain is with a unit that is in an extremely violent time and place. They're in Ramadi. And the unit is poorly led. They have a very aggressive battalion commander, and one of the companies has a extremely aggressive company commander.
Why do you say he's aggressive? You want a Marine Corps leader to be aggressive. That's
right. Yeah. So you want him to be aggressive, but one of the things here is the Marines are supposed to be doing counterinsurgency, basically, And I talked earlier about sort of the morally bruising battlefield, right? The insurgency hides among the civilian population. And the, when they're in training, that battalion, one of the trainers sort of says, like, I'm a little concerned that this battalion is overly focused on killing people. And there's a huge difference between, I mean, I remember training, there's one battalion that was training to go to Afghanistan, and they had excellent leaders, right? And if you asked any one of the Lance Corporals how they were going to be successful in Afghanistan, he would have said, we're going to be culturally effective, right? Because, you know, what starts off at the top goes down to the bottom, and sort of even the Lance Corporal, the lowest guys getting the message that we, in order to navigate this combat environment successfully, yes, we need to be aggressive, and you know, if a firefight starts, we need to end it. We're going to win that engagement, but we also need to work with the local population and also not do anything that would alienate the local population, right? And this battalion in the story, they don't have that kind of leadership. They're not interested in that kind of sensitivity, and then they have a very aggressive company commander who is sort of overly fixated on, you know, guys getting into firefights and shooting people, and that kind of plays out over the length of the deployment as the situation is just extremely violent and chaotic, and these guys get put under more and more pressure.
What does the chaplain have to do with all of this?
Right. So the chaplain is a chaplain for that unit, and one of the Marines comes and talks to him. And this Marine, Rodriguez, is worried that his unit has lost restraint, that they've been killing civilians, basically. And that's what he alludes to, that he thinks that that's happened. And the chaplain then... tries to work through that, both in terms of practical terms, how can he try and help that in a practical way in order to ensure that that doesn't happen, but also how to deal with what these guys are going through on a moral and spiritual level. And that's what plays out in that story.
Well, he expresses his concern about the over-aggressiveness and lack of concern for the surrounding civilian population to a whole group of leaders, and doesn't get anywhere, I guess, at least as I read your story.
Right.
And so how does he deal? How does he just have to collapse? As a chaplain, he realizes that he didn't have any impact on the way that they fight the war.
Well, the company that's sort of the worst, their AO is shrunk throughout the course of the deployment, so they're given less responsibility. So there are things that happen, but he very much feels unable to prevent the sort of things that are going on, and he feels powerless as a chaplain. And he's also not sure how to minister to these men, right? How to reach them, and he tries, and he gives a sermon that doesn't go over very well. And he reaches out to a mentor of his from back home. But it's ultimately it's not within his power to make the kind of decisions that he'd like to make.
Yeah, well, I thought it was a very powerful story in terms of, again, putting myself in somebody else's shoes as someone who tries to have a moral perspective on it, being thrown into an immoral situation, but at the same time being required to be supportive and to minister to the people whose work you may not respect as much. And it came across as an awful and very trying conflict that this chaplain had to try to live with.
Right, and then he continues to administer to them when they come back.
I'm visiting with Phil Klei about his book Redeployment. He and I are going to take a break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Phil Klei. Phil's the author of Redeployment. It's about Marines and others serving in Iraq and then coming back home. Phil, I think you know that one of my favorite stories is one called Psychological Operations.
Yes.
And it could be a novel. I mean, it's got so many complex themes in it. Will you tell us about the story, or are you going to make me tell about the story?
I will. So the narrator of the story is an Army guy. He's the one Army guy that I put in there. And he'd been a psychological operations specialist when he was in Iraq. He was at the second battle of, he was at the Battle of Fallujah. And he's also, he's a first generation, his parents are Egyptian immigrants, but they're Coptic Christians. So he's Arab, but he's Christian, and his family has a kind of complex history in regards to that, as a minority group in Egypt. And he goes, the story starts when he's at college, and he's a veteran,
Amherst. I mean, he's at the one of the top flight liberal arts colleges in the country.
Yeah,
we're surrounded by, I'm sorry, I told you I was going to let you tell the story.
Yeah, go for it.
No, well, I love the story, but don't get me started. Go ahead. I apologize. Keep going.
Right. So he's at college. He's at Amherst. And, there are not a lot of vets around him. He's in this college with all these, with the demographic that you find at liberal arts colleges. And he is sort of enthralled by this one other student. who's an African-American student, and one of the things that he does while he's in school is he kind of leverages his status as a veteran in a certain way, because he knows sort of all the ideas about veterans that I'll just read a section maybe of the story.
Okay.
Just a little
okay.
bit.
All right.
At the time, I tended to play the world-weary vet who'd seen something of life and could look at my fellow students' idealism with only the wistful sadness of a parent whose child is getting too old to believe in Santa Claus. It's amazing how well the veteran mystique plays, even at a school like Amherst, where I'd have thought the kids would be smart enough to know better. There's an old joke, how many Vietnam vets does it take to screw in a light bulb? You wouldn't know. You weren't there. And that's really the game. Everyone assumed I'd had some soul-scarring encounter with the real, the harsh, unvarnished, violent world as it actually is, outside the bubble of America and academia, a sojourn to the heart of darkness that either destroys you or leaves you sadder and wiser. It's BS, of course. Overseas, I learned mainly that yes, even tough men will piss themselves if things get scary enough, and no, it's not pleasant to be shot at, thank you very much. But other than that, the only thing I really felt I had on these kids was the knowledge of just how nasty and awful humans are.
Well, the stories you mentioned, the woman whom he's fascinated with and becomes a major character in the story is African-American, and the narrator is Egyptian. So he's, I guess we should say, he's sort of black. I mean, he's
he's Arabic.
I don't know whether he's an African-American or not. He's colored, I guess that would. I mean,
he's not white.
He's not white, and he views himself sort of. I guess he's learned to view himself sort of as an African American. In any event, more complicated because he's a Christian Egyptian in heritage, so he can speak Arabic,
yes.
Which makes him a valuable commodity in Iraq and in the area.
Right. Well, they think that they've got it made because he speaks Egyptian Arabic, not knowing that there's a big difference between Egyptian Arabic and Iraqi Arabic.
But he
trains himself in Iraqi Arabic and is able to talk. Yeah.
The armed forces. I just couldn't believe this. The armed forces, after all of this, thinks that anybody who can speak Arabic anywhere without further training, and so they deny him. They deny him the great army language school training in Iraqi Arabic or the dialect spoken. That's unbelievable, isn't it?
That's early in the war, but yeah, that happened. I know a linguist who was sent to Monterey. They trained her in the wrong dialect. That's early in the war. So, you know, he's doing this very early on because he's in Fallujah in 2004.
But in any event, as you point out, he learns he's ambitious, or he's mm-hmm. He learns the enough of the Iraqi dialect to be very effective.
Right.
And the powerful one of the powerful events, gosh, I mean, there's several powerful events. One of the powerful events is his story that he tells this woman at a point in their friendship about what he did, what his big about how he worked, how he caused the death of insurgents, even though he was just a psychological operations expert.
Right.
Can you tell that? Will you tell us that story?
So, yeah, one of the things he talks about is sort of, he talks about language as a technology, right? And he basically says, I was part of a weapons system, you know? There's a kind of repeated trope in the story about perception is reality. And one of the things that they did at in Fallujah was they'd go on the loudspeakers and broadcast insults, right? And Batoons would like compete with each other to think up great insults, and then they'd shout insults at the insurgents to try and taunt them into charging, right, or attacking a position so the Marines could kill them.
Can you, Phil, explain to us? This was new to me as a warfare technique, in the sense that part of what had to happen in Iraq is that in order to do battle with the insurgents and keep them from just being snipers or hold out. You had to get them out in the open where you could shoot at them. And,
right.
And how do you do that?
Well, there were a lot of things that psychological operations guys did, and the insurgents would, you know, they had their, you know, loudspeakers up that were, you know, shouting their own messages, and sometimes they were using the loudspeakers to coordinate attacks, and so, you know, the Marines would play like AC/DC or whatever. I remember, you know, one account where they would play the chuckle from the movie Predator when the alien laughs.
Uh-huh.
That, like, deep kind of evil chuckle just to be creepy. You know, so different ways in which you could just use loudspeakers.
It's almost like, it's sort of like gang warfare. It's not like battlefield warfare, but you're in an urban setting and
right.
got buildings, and so you hurl insults at each other as a part of the warfare, like maybe in the very old days, armies would shout out, or like when David came up against Goliath, the Philistines and the Israelites were hurling insults at each other. That
right.
that's sort of the recreation of that kind of battlefield in Iraq.
And he knows the name of one of the insurgents, and he knows something about him from the S2. So he's able to specifically sort of shame one of the insurgents, particularly by using kind of sexual insults.
What do you mean by that, sexual insult? What is that?
Well, he basically, I mean, he threatens sexual violence to his family. And his sort of thought is that, you know, if this guy is so deeply shamed, he'll have no option but to, you know, to come out and fight, because just for the simple fact that he'll have been directly called out and his men won't look at him the same way.
And so it works. It works.
It works.
He comes out and he gets killed, and that's it. Mm-hmm. That's the our narrator's story.
Right. And it's an ugly story, and it's one that, you know, so there are a couple sort of ways in which it gets, you know, because when he comes back to his father, who's extremely proud of his son and what he's done, and yet there's you know, a disconnect between the father's imagination of, you know, how the war would be fought, and the sort of kind of ugly way in which some of the things that happen in war, how they happen. And the son sort of throws that in the father's face. And then later he tells it to this fellow student, the same story, but for a different purpose, right? It's complicated why he's telling the story to the fellow student.
No, I think in a story you get as much complexity and character development as you do in many novels. So it is one of my favorites, but there's so many other stories, and I haven't given you that. We've got a minute. If I missed one that you really like to talk about or like to sell as a part of it.
I like them all. That's why I put them
I know you do.
There's stories that didn't make it.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Well, how can we get them? How can we read them?
Oh, nobody's ever going to read them.
Well, Phil Clyde, before we stop, are you stuck in Iraq, or is that are you still writing about Iraq, or you've got some other ideas about things that might be?
There's more that I would like to write about. So, yeah, we'll see.
What does more mean? I mean, what's going through your mind?
Well, I'm working on something now, but we'll see how it goes. I'm keeping it close to the vest currently.
Boy, you sure are. Can't even give us a hint. Well, all right, Phil Clyde, you've done enough. Thanks for this great book, Redeployment, for
Thank
the
you.
Stories, and for being so generous in coming to North Carolina to talk about it, and then letting us visit with you again, so that what you gave to Durham over at Duke, you've now shared with the folks in Chapel Hill as well. Thanks a lot. Thanks to Phil Clay for his book. Thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.